Good evening, everyone. And good Yom Tov. Tonight, Yud Tes Kislev. That's the Rosh Hashanah Chassidus, special Chabad day. It's on merit. And we're honored to have Rabbi Manas Friedman here. I think he's a man who needs no introduction, but we'll introduce him anyway just quickly. He's a well-known scholar, teacher, inspirer, author. I'll introduce him with a story, which I've said before, but I'd like to say it again, because part of the message of the story is that you never know how many people you touch and how many people you inspire. And of course, Rabbi Friedman, who is inspired that we know of countless people, is inspired even more. So I heard a big Chabad supporter who was speaking at it was actually Kinnis HaShluchim, the Shluchim conference in Crown Heights, a number of years ago. And the topic wasn't even Rabbi Friedman, but it turned out it was. So he said that he was having a terrible day in business. This was in days when that didn't normally happen. And totally upset. And he decided to take a break. And what he'll do, he lived in another city. He's going to call a Judaica shop in Crown Heights and order a sefer. You know, get a book, and that'll be his escape. I think that eventually they'll mail this book to him, and that's something Jewish to learn. So in the meantime, you know, having a terrible day, they say they put him on hold. Who's on the tape on hold? It wasn't music. It was a lecture from Rabbi Friedman. And I remember the story. The context was, everything is run by Hashem. It's all divine providence. And even if you think things are bad, it's really for a higher purpose. And very soothing words about how the great plan is run by Hashem. And try not to worry about the bumps in the road and the off days and the bad hair days. And he was really getting relaxed. I was getting relaxed hearing him say over the story how he was getting relaxed and soothed by hearing the tape of Rabbi Friedman. You following this? So, anyway, finally, the person in the story picks up the phone again and says, okay, can I help you? Like, you want to order a book? So the businessman says, you want to help me? Put me back on hold. So, here's Rabbi Friedman.
Good evening. We're here to talk about speaking to children about God. Of course, before you speak to the children about God, you got to get your own thoughts in order and have your ideas of God clear in your own mind. But in such a way that you can convey it even to children. So let's start at the simple beginnings. There are certain things about childhood that we should outgrow. And we do, usually, more or less. There are some things about childhood that we should not ever outgrow. So we want to get rid of all childish behavior and emotions. You never want to get rid of childlike emotions. What is the virtue of childlike emotions? A child has no problem with truth. Simple truth. Things are what they are. This is a tree. Oh, okay. Children ask, who put the tree there? You say, God. They say, okay. That's not childish. That's childlike. Before we get so complex, before we get so cynical or suspicious, before we are lied to enough times that we start to doubt almost everything we hear, we have a childlike quality that recognizes a truth simply for what it is, without complicating it. This is a quality that we should never lose for a number of reasons, as we'll talk about in a moment. So, for example, if you say to somebody, God created the world in 6 days, and a person says, you don't expect me to believe that, do you? You can't believe that. Let's understand what the problem is. What is the objection? God created the world. Do you have an objection to that? Do you have a problem with that? What's the problem? You expect me to believe that God created the world? Yeah. 3,300 years ago, God came down on a mountain called Sinai, and he gave us the Ten Commandments, and here they are. These Ten Commandments. Oh, you can't really believe that. Why not? There are certain things that logic cannot accept. It's not logical. Why? Because it doesn't add up. That's what logic means. 2 and 2 is 4, not 5. That's logical. There are some things that go against logic. So your intelligent mind rejects it and says, no, I can't. This doesn't compute. But if I tell you that God spoke to us at Mount Sinai, what logical, reasonable argument do you have that makes you reject that statement? So when people say, oh, I don't think I believe that, I say, that's a mistake. It's not a question of believing it. And if you say, yes, I do think God spoke to us at Sinai 3,000 years ago, that means you have faith. Faith, a leap of faith, means that you suspend logic. You accept something despite intelligent, reasonable objections. And you say, well, I don't care, I believe it. And there is faith. It does have its purpose, it has its place, and it has its role. But this is not faith at all. Let's try it again. I come to you and I say, 3,000 years ago, something happened that never happened again. It was a one-time thing. Strange. God spoke at Mount Sinai. And you say, oh, I don't think so. You don't think so? Can't expect me to believe that. No, I don't expect you to believe that. I expect you to believe me. People were there, and they said that it happened. Unless you think they're all liars, unless you have reason to believe they're all liars, if they said it happened, well, then it happened. Where is the suspension of logic? How are you contradicting your intelligent, logical mind? You're not. There's nothing illogical about it. The only objection really is, I don't know what you're talking about. God spoke? What's God? All right, that's a good question. It works like this. The only time you could have a logical objection to the statement that 3,000 years ago on Shavuos, God spoke to us at Mount Sinai, is if you know for a fact that day he was in Cleveland. Now you've got a problem. But if you don't know that he was in Cleveland, so he was at Mount Sinai. What's the problem? Who was at Mount Sinai? God. I never saw God. Right. So what's the problem? I don't even know what God is. Right. What's your problem? Here's a simple example. The first explorer to ever come back from Australia comes back to New York and says, you're not going to believe this. There's an animal in Australia that hops around on its hind legs. I know it sounds weird. And it carries its young in a pocket. And you say, oh, come on, I don't believe that. You don't believe that? Why? Because you're intelligent? Or because you never saw one? So the guy who comes back from Australia says, I saw an animal you never saw. And you say, oh, I don't believe that. I never saw one. I say, right, exactly. That's why I'm telling you. You weren't there. You're never going to go there. You're never going to see it. But I'm telling you, there is an animal like that. And if you say, no, I can't accept that. On what grounds? Let me ask you a question. What is more natural? What is healthier? What is more normal? When you hear something completely outlandish, something you've never heard before, what is your healthy, appropriate, reasonable response? Do you believe it unless proven otherwise? Or do you doubt it unless proven otherwise? Well, let's take a look at children. Whatever you tell a child that he doesn't know otherwise, that he hasn't had an opposite experience, whatever you tell a child, well, that's great. You'll live and learn. Never heard of a kangaroo until today. Now I know there's a kangaroo. The fact that I didn't know about a kangaroo yesterday doesn't mean I should doubt it today. It's like you hear a six-year-old, you say something to a six-year-old. You tell him something. And the six-year-old says, oh no, I never heard that. Right. You're 6 years old. You haven't heard many things. And you're going to hear about them. And you're going to learn about it. So what is this childlike quality? The childlike quality is you are open to new information and you welcome it. Like a sponge, you absorb it, you soak it up. And any time you can learn something new and hear something you've never heard before, you're excited, you're disposed to it, you want to learn more, tell me more, and the stranger it is, the more interesting and the more enjoyable. So the first thing when we speak to children about God is that we can't present God as a theory, an opinion, a feeling. That's simply not telling the truth. When a person comes and says, you believe in God? Can you prove he exists? See, just childlike, innocent logic says, how long has it been that people all over the world have been speaking about God? How long? 4,000 years? 5,000 years? For as long as we can remember? If God has been spoken of for 5,000 years, and now you ask me to prove that he exists, not necessary. God exists. He's a topic of conversation for a long, long time. You may like him, you may hate him. You may think he's nice, you may think he's nasty. But that there's no God, that's hardly possible. What have we been talking about for 5,000 years? Or in simple language, logic 101, God is the status quo. If you want to argue that there is no God, the burden of proof is on you. After 5,000 years of speaking of God, you would have to bring strong proof that there is no God. So, not faith, not a leap of faith, not a suspension of logic, but simply a historical precedent, a historical fact. God has been around for 5,000 years. Some teenager, wise guy, was arguing with me, and he basically said, why should I do what God says? That week, the cover story on Newsweek magazine was something about prayer in public school, and the title on the cover was putting God back into the schools, and the word God was printed in about 4-inch letters on the cover of Newsweek. So I said, why should you listen to God? God gets his name on the cover of Newsweek. When was your name on the cover of Newsweek? So have a little respect. God has been around. People have believed or disbelieved or argued or found many gods, changed gods, but God has been around. And therefore, you have to present God to children as an old established fact. Now the question is, what do you tell children about God? What about God? We've learned a painful lesson in recent times. There are different aspects of God that people relate to or get excited about. As, for example, God is powerful. God is almighty. God is awesome. That's probably true. Is that what you want to tell your children? That you are excited about God because he's very powerful? That's not the Jewish message. Is God powerful? I guess. Is that what inspires you? No. I mean, God is powerful, I'm not, so good for him. God is awesome, you know, so is the Grand Canyon. Why are you inspired by God? Why are you taking him seriously? The proper answer to this, we say it in the Haggadah on Pesach, which is geared for children, which is understandable to a child. What inspires us about God is not that he is all-powerful, and not that he is all forgiving, which of course assumes that you need to be forgiven. We are inspired by God because he created the world before we asked him to. Which means, I don't need him as much as he needs me. Because he created me when I didn't even exist. To take it a step further, we were busy building pyramids in Egypt, and God came down to Egypt and took us out of there, brought us to Mount Sinai, and said, marry me. Be my people. He came looking for us. We have a class, Beis Chana, which is a crash course on Judaism for women. On a mature level. We had a session in Palm Springs in California, and some of the local women invited their husbands to come with them. So there was this one man there who, I don't remember what I was saying or what the topic was at the time. He interrupts, he raises his hand and he says, excuse me, that's only according to Judaism. I said, well, this is a class on Judaism. Expect to hear Jewish thought. A few minutes later, he raises his hand again. He says, but you're only talking about Judaism. I said, that's right. That's what we're here for. And again he interrupts. And he says, why do you think Judaism is the only religion? What makes you think Judaism is the best religion? Have you tried Buddhism? So the guy's not giving up. So how do you answer this kind of a question? So I said, you know, I live in Minnesota for 30 years. Don't ask me why. And the airport is the hub for Northwest Airlines. So they have a monopoly on the airport. I travel a lot, East Coast, West Coast. So, more likely than not, I'm traveling Northwest. I'm flying Northwest. Imagine if someone would stop me at the airport and say, always with the Northwest. Again with the Northwest. What makes you think Northwest is the best airline in the world? What do you think, it's the only airline in the world? Have you tried Southeast? My answer would be very simple. I'm not interested in airlines. I'm not shopping for an airline. I don't care what the name of the airline is. I don't care what colors they paint on their airplanes. I have a destination. Whoever takes me there, that's who I go with. I need to go to New York. Northwest will take me there. So I go with Northwest. Oh, but why don't you try Southeast? Because Southeast goes to Florida. I'm not going to Florida. So what do you mean, try it? Take a flight on Southeast to see if it really goes to Florida? I'm sure it goes to Florida. I don't want to go there. So what do you mean, try it? If someday I need to go to Florida, I will go with Southeast. Absolutely. The same is true with religions. Most normal people, most intelligent people, most well-balanced people do not go shopping for a religion. People have destinations. And if a religion takes them there, then they'll practice that religion. So you really don't have much of a choice once you know your destination. So for example, if your destination is enlightenment, nirvana, bliss, what are your choices? You go to the airport and you look at the board, enlightenment, Buddhist Airlines. It's the only one. Nobody else goes there. So if that's where you want to go, you take Buddhist Airlines. Suppose you don't want to be that happy. Because a Jew needs to krecht and complain once in a while. So you don't want nirvana. What you want is to be saved from Satan. You don't want to go to hell. Go to the airport. Take a look at the board. Salvation. Christian Airlines. It's the only one. If that's where you want to go, that's the airline you take. If you don't want to be saved from Satan, if you don't mind going to hell, as the joke goes, who will I know in heaven? All my friends. I want to go where my friends are going. So if you don't want to be saved from hell, if instead your destination is that when you die you want to have 72... Right? You go to the airport and you take a look at the board, Virgin Airlines. There's only one religion that'll take you there. So there really isn't a choice. Once you know your destination, you go with the religion that offers that destination. What is the destination of Judaism? It's interesting. Jews know the destination of Buddhism, of Christianity, of Islam. What's the destination of Judaism? It's actually a compliment to us that we've gone 3,000 years and we never stopped to ask. By the way, where are we going? Where are we headed? Whatever. Light your candles, make a bracha, and let's keep it moving. Yeah, so where is this going to get us? There's something very nice about that. But it would be helpful to know what our destination is. Our destination, simply put, is that at some point in your life, when you realize that everything you have comes from God, everything you want comes from God, All the things you never asked for and don't want come from God. And that when you need more, you're going to ask Him. And if He doesn't give you, you're going to be angry at Him or upset and disappointed. At some point, you feel, I can't just take. I got to give back. I have to give something in return. Doesn't feel right. That's the destination of Judaism. To do something in return for God. Something He really can use. Not another tie. So, the man says, well, why don't you try Buddhism? No. Imagine if I tried Buddhism. If I went to the Dalai Lama and I said, I want to do something for God. What does He need? We all know what the answer is. The answer is, God is bliss. God is contentment. God doesn't need anything. Thank you very much. If you want to have bliss, if you want that kind of contentment, we can teach you how to get it. So, try Christianity. So, you go to the Pope. And you say, I want to do something for God. What does God need? You know what the answer is going to be. You are born in sin. You need. God doesn't need. I'll pray for you. So you go to the Muslims. And you say, I want to do something for God. What does God need from me? And they will kill you. For blasphemy. For even suggesting that God could need something from you, lowly, worthless, miserable creature. God is powerful. So when all else fails, you go to a rabbi. And you say to the rabbi, isn't there one thing I can do for God? And of course he answers a question with a question. He says, why only one thing? It just so happens that there are 613 things that you can do for him that he really needs. So, pick a mitzvah. That's the destination of Judaism. And that's why we say in the Haggadah, we are grateful forever to God who came to Egypt and took us out. What are we grateful for? That we don't have to build pyramids anymore? No. We're grateful for the fact that He came to take us out. We didn't go looking for a religion. We're not the type. Jews are not the religious type. God came to us. God came to us and said, I need you. Well, how can you refuse that? How can you say no to that? That's what inspires us. Not that God is forgiving and not that God is powerful, but that God asked. He came to us and asked that we do for Him. What are you going to say? No? That's Judaism. That's our relationship with God. When you talk to children about God, and you've established, of course, the fact that God exists and always has existed and people have always known about it and so on, the next step is, why should we be excited about God? What is it about God that inspires us? He's waiting. He needs us to do this. He gave us the world. And He asks us to do this. How can you refuse? So, you say to a child, that candy you shouldn't eat because it's not kosher. God doesn't want you to eat that candy. Before you eat, make a bracha. Because God is waiting to hear a bracha from you. That is the simple, uncomplicated, unadulterated truth that children thrive on better than adults. That's how we introduce God to children. But that's also how we should relate to God. It's not childish, it's childlike, and that's a good thing. If we move on, the next step in raising a healthy child who serves God properly, what is the most important thing a child needs to know emotionally? The most important thing, I guess, is security. Security. To know that nothing can go wrong. If we can't give children security, we leave them vulnerable for the rest of their lives. The worst thing you can do for a child is deny them the security that they need. Which is why parents need to be perfect. Because their children need them to be perfect. At least for the first 5 years. How do you make children secure? You can't do it by lying to them. That's the worst thing you can do to a child. So you can't tell them that there are fairies that give you quarters for your teeth. You can't tell them about Santa Claus. You can't make up stories and hope that that will reassure them. Because if you make up a story, they sense it. They know it immediately. You have to tell them the truth. What is the truth? What is secure about the world? How are you secure? What makes you confident that there will be a tomorrow? What makes you confident is the fact that God created the world with a plan. And His plan is a good one, a generous one. And His plan can't fail. Therefore, whatever is going to happen tomorrow is going to happen for a reason, a good reason, and a kind reason. That's true. What about all the bad things that happen? The bad things that happen are really part of the plan, part of the goodness, but not the type that we can understand. Not the type that we can appreciate. Our children understand this very well. They know that what they think is good is not the same as what parents think is good. They know that if parents say, no, you cannot play on the highway, and no, you cannot play with matches, and you can't have a fourth ice cream, they know that to them it sounds cruel and punishing, but to the parents it's a good idea. It's a kindness. And that's, of course, if it's a mature child. I have this question and answer session with teenagers, and some they write in their questions. And one girl wrote in, what is the purpose of life? I'm 13. That was very wise. It's like, what is the purpose of life? Oh, by the way, what do I know? I'm 13. So children know, and that's why they want security from you. Because they don't trust their own judgment. So when things feel bad to them, but the parents say it's a good thing, they learn to trust the parents' adult, mature opinion. Of course, the same is true with God. We know that God is running the world for the benefit of the world. He created the world because He wants a good one, a perfect one, a godly one. And everything that happens is a step in that direction. When we look at events and we think, whoa, we're going backwards, like every time you open up a newspaper, it looks like we're going backwards. Well, it does, because God is much older than us. And so he thinks differently. He sees differently. But we can be secure in the knowledge that it's his world and he wants it to be good a lot more than we do. And therefore, it is for the good. You have to believe that. You have to trust that. And then you can convey it to your children. The result of this is Jewish people never get discouraged. How is it that in our history we have had such serious setbacks? I mean, no need to mention the Holocaust, but similar events in more recent, more distant history. How is it that we bounce back? How is it that after the Holocaust people had babies? What kind of strength, what kind of confidence, what kind of security do we have that enables us to start life again because it's good after what we've seen? If this is good, what will it take to convince you that life is bad? And yet, we complain, we get angry, we rebel, and then we go back to living. That comes from a very deep-seated, deeply ingrained trust that God is good, life is good, the world is good, let's keep living. That's a very important ingredient. When we have children at very young ages becoming disillusioned with life, indifferent to life, they're missing some really vital ingredient that our parents and grandparents did manage to give us, even in the worst of times. Psychologically, we're told in modern psychology that making a child secure, giving a child confidence, is achieved by giving them a good self-image. They should think well of themselves. Don't criticize a child. Compliment them. Tell him he's wonderful. Tell him he's capable. Tell him he's important, etc., etc. And that will give him a good self-image, and with a good self-image, you can accomplish anything. And if any child ever has a problem, it's probably low self-image. But if you think about it, what truly makes a child strong? What gives a child a firm shape so he knows this is me, and it's strong, and it's firm, it's solid? If you compliment them and say, you're so cute, you're so adorable, well, somebody is going to come along who's cuter, adorabler. And then what? You say to the child, you're so smart, you're so... And when somebody smarter comes along, or when they go up to the next grade and they can't understand what the teacher is saying, now what? What really makes a child strong is having borders. A child who has borders knows exactly who he or she is, and that is strength. So, for example, if a child says to his friends, I gotta leave now, I have to be home by 8. That is healthy. Maybe you can stay, but I have to be home by 8. That's me. That's where I come from. I have to be home at 8. When a child says to his non-Jewish friends, you can have that candy, but I can't. It's not kosher. I don't eat non-kosher. That is so strong. That is so firm. A child knows, I can't go there. I belong here. That's strength. I do this because that's who I am. That is strong. And then you don't compare to anybody else. Then nothing can come along and say, oh yeah, well, I'm better. What better than what? My definition of myself comes from knowing my beginning and my end. This is me. I do this, I don't do that. These are my limits. I don't go there. A child who knows right from wrong is a much healthier child than the child who thinks he's great. Does that make sense? You think you're great, wait till you run into a problem. But if you know right from wrong, no matter what happens, you know right from wrong. Let me share with you a really incredible little story. It doesn't have a lot of drama, and it doesn't have a chase scene. But it's a really good story. Back in the bad old days in Russia, when people were dying in the streets from hunger, from disease, there was a woman whose husband had been sent to Siberia free of charge, and she was left alone to raise her child, 8-year-old boy. She couldn't live in the large city because the KGB were looking for her, so she moved out into a farming village. But there was nothing. There was nothing for her to, there was no way for her to feed her child. So in desperation, she needed to go into the big city to some relative or some friend or something where she could get some food. She figured that the trip would take 4 days, and she couldn't take the child along with her. So she left the child with a Russian couple, a neighbor, who were not Jewish. She told the boy what he may eat and what he may not eat in their house, and said that she would be back in 4 days. She went on this trip, and of course the trains were not running, everything was in chaos, so a week goes by and she has not come back. This couple, the woman was very kind, she was a motherly type, but the husband was an alcoholic. Is that redundant? He was a Russian alcoholic. And he would have fun at the expense of a little boy. He would come home at night drunk, and he would try to force the child to eat something that wasn't kosher. And the kid would fight and kick and scream, and he would try to force it into his mouth, and it was loud, and the woman couldn't take it. So after a week, and the mother hadn't come back, she took the child and put him into an orphanage. At the orphanage, nobody forced him to eat anything he didn't want to eat, but he felt very uncomfortable because it was always being questioned, why can't you, and what's wrong with you, and everybody else can eat it, why can't you eat it? And another week goes by. Mother doesn't return. Now one day, the orphanage takes the children on a hike. It was a summer day. They go on a hike. And towards the end of the hike, they're all perspiring, and it's hot, and they're thirsty. So they go into a farm, and they ask the farmer if there's something cold for the children to drink. So the farmer brings out a pitcher of cold milk, gives each child a glass, and fills their glasses with milk. Now this little boy, he was 8 years old at the time, he now lives in Chicago, he was thrilled to have the drink, and he's about to drink it when he hears the farmer saying to the counselor, this is very good for the children, they should drink this. There's nothing healthier than horse's milk. So the little boy hears this, and now he doesn't know what to do. Horse's milk, of course, is not kosher, so he shouldn't drink it. On the other hand, he's thirsty. And if he doesn't drink it, he'll just start a whole nother kind. Oh, this is not kosher either. What's wrong with milk? So he doesn't know what to do. And this 8-year-old child goes through a moral crisis. To drink it or not to drink it. In the end, he decides he's not going to drink it. But to avoid making a scene, he makes believe that the glass fell out of his hand. And the milk spilled, and there's no more. While this is going on, the mother comes back. In those days, children were being kidnapped all over the country. She comes back to this couple, and she says, "Where is my son?" And they said, "Oh, we put him in an orphanage." And she started to panic. She goes to the orphanage, and he says, "Where is my son?" "Well, he's not here right now." Now she's really panicking. She's beside herself. And she's standing in front of the orphanage, doesn't know what to do. The group, the children, are returning from their hike. And this little boy sees his mother. And he goes running towards her. And he shouts to her in Yiddish, "Mama, ich bin deine. I'm still yours. I didn't drink it. I'm still yours. I didn't drink it." What kept the child from drinking the non-kosher milk is not because he was religious, or because he was holy, or because he was pious, or because he was afraid of going to hell. He didn't drink it because his mother doesn't drink it. And if he does, then he's removing himself. He's putting himself in a different place. Then they're not on the same page. Then they live in different universes. And he wouldn't do that. So he refused to drink it. And now he comes running to his mother and he says, "Mama, I'm still yours. I'm loyal to you. I didn't drink it." That is a powerful, I mean, much more powerful than a good self-image. You know where you need to be, even at 8 years old. "This is who I am. This is where I belong. I am my mother's child. So I do what my mother does. I'm still hers." That is so strong. That is so healthy. And that's what's kept us. That's what's kept us. After every disaster, after every tragedy, after every Holocaust, we bounce back. Why? Not because we have a good self-image. Unfortunately, we have a terrible self-image. But we know where we belong. We know where we belong. So Jews come to synagogues on Yom Kippur. Are they religious? No. Are they believers? No. Are they afraid of going to hell? No. Do they want to become Orthodox? No. Why are you coming to the synagogue? Because on Yom Kippur, a Jew belongs in a synagogue. I know where I belong. Maybe I should come more often, but at least on Yom Kippur. I show up because I belong. That's strength. That's security. That's firmness. So when we teach our children, not only about God, but about our people, what does it mean to be a Jew? What have Jews been all these years? What is it that's different about Jews? Very powerful. So in addition to telling your children about God, you also need to tell them about their grandmother. How great she was. How special, how strong, how Jewish. A child knows that their existence didn't begin with them, that they can trace their roots back. It gives them strength. It's a lifeline. You know you come from special people. All of a sudden, your existence takes on a greater significance. Children who don't know their grandparents or their great-grandparents are cheated out of something very precious. You have to tell them about their grandparents' greatness. Everything wise, everything smart you have to say, you got to attribute it to your parents. Extend the bloodline. Extend the family bigger into the past, and it will help them in the future. So share wisdom with your children. Tell them what's right and what's wrong, and say that you heard this from your grandmother. Even if you didn't. It's okay to lie once in a while. And chances are you did. You forgot. Where else did you get your wisdom from? Not from your grandmother? Of course from your grandmother. And one other thing. Our grandparents really were bigger than life. They had problems, perhaps. They were not perfect in many ways. But they were heroes. Because they didn't give up on being Jewish. And that is heroic where they were coming from. Truly heroic. Somebody asked me recently after the events in India, Mumbai, with the Chabad house. Somebody said to me, so I don't understand. So what is Chabad? That is a very difficult question. Because we've had a very hard time defining what Chabad is. But now people realize, wait a minute, you're not just a little group of guys running around giving out menorahs. You had a Chabad house in Mumbai, and people stayed there even though it was dangerous, and they didn't give up the position. And what is Chabad? And the best thing I could say was, after what happened last week or 2 weeks ago in Mumbai, a young couple with a baby are moving out to that neighborhood, Bangalore, to open another Chabad house. You get the picture? That's Chabad. It's not martyrs. They're not looking to be heroes. There is something that needs to be done. It's good, it's right, it's necessary. So we go. It's the way Jews have always been. When you know right from wrong, you are indestructible. You're invincible. Right is right, wrong is wrong. What part of that don't you understand? The clarity, moral clarity, the clarity of mitzvah versus sin, that is such an empowering thing, that is so strong, that it scares the bad guys. They're afraid of it, because it exposes their weakness, because they don't know right from wrong. So moral clarity is really a healthy ingredient in human beings and in raising healthy children. So let's review it. You tell children about God not as a subject of faith, not as a suspension of logic, but simply as an established fact. There's no need for justification, for argumentation, for apologetics. You don't have to explain why you think there's a God. You don't have to offer proofs that there's a God. Simply state the fact. What is it about God that we're excited about? Why should we care that there is a God? Because He asked. He came to us. He needs something. And our destination is to give something back. So do the mitzvah. Because God is waiting, hoping that you will do the mitzvah. You didn't do it yesterday, then he's even more hopeful that you'll do it today. And the result is that knowing right from wrong, knowing where I belong and where I don't belong, what I do and what I don't do, what is expected of me and what is expected that I do not do, that makes me so strong, so confident, so firm to wake up in the morning and know what you're about. That's a blessing. And in today's world, more and more people wake up in the morning and they don't know why. Oh, they know what they have to do, but they don't know what they're about. So they go through their day, come home and have a drink, or pop a Valium, or a Prozac, or no need for that. Wake up in the morning clear about who you are, where you belong, and what is expected of you, and serve God. That's our destination. It is so healthy. It's so childlike, which is good for adults, and certainly good for children. Have any ideas or any thoughts you'd like to share? Any questions? Objections? Anything? Yes?
I want to share a conversation between two of my grandchildren. My daughter just shared when I told her I was coming here. She was having they were having a discussion, a four-year-old and a three-year-old. What color is Hashem? So one kid said white, the other one said no, beige. But nobody said black. It was an interesting insight. They didn't have, it was white or beige, but it wasn't black.
Or green, or purple, or pink.
So it just reaffirms the truth that they see it in the positive, in the good.
Light.
Light. I think it might help to lose the thought, but it seems to me they might feel like they want the Hashem to look like they do.
And one of them thought I'm white, and the other one thought I'm beige.
Yeah.
That's fine. Yes.
I have a two-part question. I have a 2-year-old and 4-year-old. My 4-year-old, slightly the grandfather, very zealous, righteous child. But it's kind of like, I don't want to dapper, especially a lot of people, but you don't like to tell anyone about how well Christians are walking down the street, and how Christmas joy just, and what do you do that in New York City when you're surrounded by all these Christians around in Christmas time, and he's saying, you know, what Jesus became of, God is a man, that's impossible, and he's walking on the street saying these things when he sees Christmas trees.
Get him his own television show. Be a TV preacher.
It's kind of like I walk down the street and I'm like, oh, this is going to go work because one of our people is watching and you've got to find what's going to be there. What do you do, Rabbi? What do you say?
First of all, tell me the truth. Who did you get it from?
I think from both sides of that.
A zealous family. I wouldn't worry about it.
Really?
Yeah, you apologize to the people and say, he's cute.
I don't want to get things.
That's right. That's right.
Have
you tried? Well, even if he isn't, he's healthy, so.
When you talk about security for the kids, you said the best way is to teach them boundaries. Older kids, it's very hard for them, like even when it's 8 o'clock, you have to be home, right? Just an example. How can you teach them something that they're going to learn, like you said, with the grandparents, that this is the best for them without resenting or heavy anger? That kid was going to say, I have to be home. It's very hard around him to say, why am I the only one coming home at 8 o'clock when my friends are. Even with the boundaries, he can get angry and say, I'm the only one coming home at 8. How do we teach them
yes.
is the best for me.
Yeah. The problem is like this, and this is so common. You try to give your kids rules and regulations and borders, and they resent you. And that's probably the most frequently encountered problem in raising children. So what do? You try to convince the child that being home at 8 is really a good idea. That's not the point. That's not going to work. You're just going to get into an argument, which you can't win. The point is not that being home at 8 is so important. The point is having borders is so important. And we're not teaching that at all. We forget. The child should appreciate not the importance of being home at 8, but the importance of being there when you expect them to be. Right? So when you say to a child, you should do this, you should put away the toys, or you should go to sleep now. And the child says, but why do I have to? I don't want to. If you start to argue about the virtues of bedtime, if you don't go to sleep, tomorrow you're going to be tired, you're not going to do so well in school, you've lost the argument already, because he doesn't care. If you say, if you put your toys away, you'll be able to find them tomorrow, he doesn't care about that. The question is not, why should he put his toys away? The question is, why should he do what you said? Deal with the issue. What we need to teach children is how wonderful and how strong and how healthy and how good and how smart it is to do what you're told to do, whatever it is. So you say to a child who says, but I don't want to go to sleep, and you say, but you have to listen to your mother. But I don't want, why do I have to go to sleep? You have to listen to your mother. Listening is good. Now, is that true or not? It's true. I'm not so sure that the bedtime you set for your child is the best bedtime. I don't know. And I don't know if putting away the toys makes playing with it any more enjoyable. Maybe not. But listening is definitely good. So here's how we have to think about it. We want our child to be obedient. But what does obedience mean? To the child, obedience means a denial of their own feelings and of their opinions. Naturally, they rebel. Obedience means, I don't care what you want. You do what I tell you. That's what it sounds like. But going back to the story with the boy and the milk, that's not what obedience means. Obedience means, I can do this because I am obedient. It's not a denial of me. It empowers me. I can refuse the milk. Why? I obey my mother. A soldier, a well-trained soldier who goes through boot camp successfully, how does he come out on the other end? An obedient wimp who waits to be told what to do? That's a soldier? If that's how they're training soldiers, we've lost the war. Boot camp for a soldier means you have all sorts of resistance and objection and restrictions. I can't function in the rain. When I'm wet, I get uncomfortable. I can't think straight. If it's too hot, I get a headache. I can't be out in the open. I'm afraid of water. I can't swim. When you come out of boot camp successfully, hot, wet, cold, it doesn't faze you. When you have something you need to do, you can do it because you're a soldier. So the training is not to train you to be helpless without instruction. That's not what obedience is. Obedience means you have been trained in such a way that the petty restrictions that human beings have, you have lost. So when you know what you need to do, you can do it. You need to carry 60 pounds on your back for 3 miles? You do it. If you weren't a soldier, you would say, oh, I you know, hurt my back last week. So it's really an empowering thing. You tell it.
I still have a problem with the resentment.
No, the resentment comes when you're taking away their opinion or their feelings in favor of the bedtime. You're not really doing that at all. It's not about the bedtime. It's about the ability to do what needs to be done without all this shtick. So it's really empowering you, not denying you. So you have to say to a child, you see these people, they're so good. Look at how they do whatever needs to be done. You see, that's what happens when you listen. And you use stories and examples to build up, to make them appreciate the strength and the beauty and the goodness of the ability to do what has to be done without hesitation. That's a soldier. That's a healthy person. So I'm not trying to deny you your opinion. I'm not trying to deny you your feelings. Yes, you don't want to go to sleep, but you gotta listen, because listening is so admirable. It's so virtuous. It's so strong. And you're not just saying that, you mean it. You don't want to turn your kid into a wimp. So you don't deny or dismiss his feelings and say, I don't care what you think. It's, you don't think so, and you don't want to. But listening is so much more important. So good. For ourselves too, by the way. You try to discipline yourself. You try to go on a diet, and you don't want to. Or you're tempted to eat something you shouldn't eat. So what do you say to yourself? Oh, this is so fattening. It's so fattening. That doesn't help. I don't know if you noticed. It doesn't work. Yes, I know it's fattening. That's part of the attraction. That's what makes it taste so good. So that's a reason not to eat it. Instead, the discipline comes from, I can obey. I can. Like a soldier. I got to get up at 5, I get up at 5. Got to crawl through the mud, you crawl through the mud. I tell you, I have this program where I take a group of 10 men out into the boundary water area, which is like a natural preserve between Minnesota and Canada. We go fishing for 5 days out in a tent. Male bonding, you know, that kind of thing. And we study and we daven and we fish and we eat what we catch, and it's very nice, usually. One time we went out there on a Sunday night through to Thursday night, and it rained the entire time. It started raining Monday morning, and it didn't stop till Thursday afternoon. The first day we were miserable. The second day we were wet. Everything was wet. It didn't matter anymore. And we just gave up. Oh, what the heck. Everything is wet. Let's get into the boat and go fishing. So we did. We sat in the rain and fished. The water is filling up our shoes, the tops of our shoes. What's the difference? Everything is wet. To make matters worse, a storm came through. And we had to make it to the shore and pull the boats up on shore, the canoes, and stand there in the downpour. And then when we got back to our tents, they had all been blown down. Everything in the tent was wet. It was hopeless. And you know what happened? We didn't care anymore. Everything was soaked. Everything was wet. So what the heck? The mosquitoes, the worms, the dirt, the sand, we didn't care anymore. We had become earthy. And we were having a great time. It was liberating. So you're wet, you're wet. So there's sand in your food, so what? So everything you're wearing is wet, so you're sloshing around in your shoes and they're falling apart from the water. What's the difference? We were having a great time. Thursday afternoon, we leave, we go back to the port and get back into our civilian clothes, which we left at the lodge, and we get into the car for the trip home. And in this boundary water area, you're not allowed to bring any glass or aluminum. Anything that doesn't burn is pollution. So you're not allowed to bring anything of that. So you can't bring sodas or drinks other than in your plastic containers. So when we come back, they meet us, the outfitters, they meet you at the dock with a six-pack of beer and a six-pack of Coke, and you get to have a drink. So we each have something to drink, and we're in the car going back, and the car hits a bump, and a drop of Coke spills on somebody's pants. He says, "Oh, God!" And we all cracked up. But you've been wet for 3 days, and now you're freaking out over a drop? Wait, I got wet. Our sensitivities are so paralyzing. And when you know what you need to do, when you know what's right and what's wrong, you're not paralyzed anymore. Wet, wet. If you got to do it, you got to do it. One more story. Every year in Crown Heights on Yom Tov, the men all get together, men and boys, and we walk to another neighborhood and then go to the various shuls and synagogues and share the Yom Tov spirit. So we would walk to Williamsburg, to Borough Park, to East Flatbush, whatever. Every Yom Tov. It was a custom. And every year, it rained. Here we're walking for hours to the other night, and it always rains. It's almost like we were starting to think, you know we're going to go. You don't have to keep testing us over the same thing. And of course, to make it more interesting, you just bought a new hat for Yom Tov. And if you know anything about these hats, they're dyed poorly. So if you walk in the rain for 20 minutes, the dye starts to run on your newly bought white shirt. So now your collar is black. Everything is getting wet. Your shoes. You just got shoes for Yom Tov. Okay. So we're marching down the street. I don't know. 1,500 people. And we're coming around this corner, someplace in Borough Park, or near Borough Park. There's a guy and a man and his son. They're standing under a huge umbrella around the corner. And they're watching. Two by two, we're marching along, and they can't believe this. And then we notice something really interesting. The father stuck his hand out from under the umbrella to see if it was really raining. Because we were walking through it like, you know, what's the difference? We're wet. It doesn't matter anymore. So we're walking like it's not raining. And he got disoriented, like... Who's crazy here? So he stuck his hand out to see if it was raining. It was raining. So, knowing what you need to do, being clear about what's right and what's wrong, you outgrow, you transcend these petty things that paralyze us, and bad mood, and... I'm not that type, I don't go for that, I don't do that, I'm a night person, I haven't had my coffee, I mean, all these things, like, come on. If you know right from wrong, before the coffee, after the coffee, it's all the same. Right is right and wrong is wrong. So it's really empowering, and that's what we need to tell our children. I'm not trying to force you to act against your own will. I'm not imposing my will on you. I'm trying to get you to be able. So what is a soldier? A soldier is not someone who says, whatever you say. A soldier is someone who says, I can do that. Up the hill, I can do that. Down the hill, I can do that. It's really empowering. Yeah?
Mom and he doesn't
want to pay.
Should I really try to get
it? No, not a
3-year-old. Not a 12-year-old, you know, trying to get to the shore or something
like that. That's a little different. The 12-year-old you can reason with. A 3-year-old you don't you tell the child, let's say the Shema, and then you say it. And it's as if he said it, it's good enough. So whatever part he says, that's great. The rest you say, and it's fine. So it's not like, you don't want to say it? Okay, fine, we won't say it. No. It gets said a little by him, a little by you, between the two of you. But that's a 3-year-old. A 3-year-old simply needs the repetition. That's the most you can expect of a 3-year-old. With a 12-year-old, that's a different story. With a 12-year-old, you can say, You're not being responsible, or what is a bad mood? Every time you're in a bad mood, you don't do what you're supposed to do. You can reason with a 12-year-old, but you got to give them the right reason. You don't just say, "I'm telling you to say the Shema," which is another thing in child raising in general. We don't always say what we think we're saying. It's so common. I don't know what to do to get my child to stop lying. So, well, tell them it's wrong. I've told them a million times. What have you told them a million times? I've told them a million times I hate it when he lies. So you never did say it was wrong. You said you don't like it. You thought you said it was wrong. You didn't say it. So if you say to your child, how many times do I have to tell you not to lie? What have you just taught your child? Not to lie? Huh? Maybe you've taught him to count. How many times have I told you? Keeping track. Or, you know I hate it when you do that. What have you just taught him? Not to do it when you're around. It annoys me when you do that. Okay, next time I'll wait till you leave. See, you're not saying what you think you're saying. And then you wonder why the kid hasn't gotten the message. He has gotten the message. He knows exactly what you hate. And he's not sure how many times you told him. So, we got to communicate clearly. Say what needs to be said. That's not kosher. We don't do that. That's not right. We don't do that. This is good. That's how we should be. Don't say how you feel about it or how many times you've mentioned it. Talk to the issue. Children do want to listen. Children do want your approval. Unless they get frustrated because they can't seem to get it. So you have to offer approval, because that's what the child wants more than anything else in the world. You have to make your child successful. Be a successful child. All we tell our children is that they should grow up to be successful adults. But you don't get to be a successful adult if you're not first a successful child. And what does it take to be a successful child? Win your parents' approval. That's a successful child. But don't make it so hard on them that they have to give up.
bring them back, and all their siblings are children, and they just don't believe in that. They have the same education as their siblings. Can't really just, it's difficult for them.
Okay. It just may be that this one child is the more thoughtful, is the more intelligent, and the more virtuous. What he's saying is not, I don't believe in God. What he's saying is, the God that you're believing in is not mine. Shouldn't it be mine? So if you want me to believe in your God, yeah, I can do that. But that's not called believing in God. So children growing up in a religious home, at some point, hopefully at a young age, have to sit back and ask themselves, is this my thing? Is this me? Or am I just following the family? That's a very important and good thing for a child to do. It has to be yours. And when the child isn't given a way or the room or the space to make it their own, then they will rebel. And it's motivated by the right feelings, the good impulses. It has to be mine. Don't force me. Let me make it mine. But if you do force them, then they reject what you're trying to force on them and don't bother making it theirs and go off and do something else. So here's another thing you have to encourage a child. It's not your God that you want them to believe in. It's God. And you don't want them to be good for you. You want them to be good to serve God. So if a child says, well, why can't I eat non-kosher? For a 12-year-old, 11-year-old, if the child is a little bit mature, the right thing to say is, I don't know. Don't do me a favor. God wants you to keep kosher. You want to know why? Ask your teacher. Look it up. It's your thing. So it's not, you know, you can't dismiss the child who says, I am not playing. I'm not going along with the program. It doesn't mean he doesn't want the program. It means he wants it to be his own. And he's right. So we got to find a way to allow each child to make it personal to themselves. Sometimes a child needs help with that. But you certainly don't reject him or condemn him for wanting it to be his own. It's a good thing. It's what keeps it real. Yeah.
What happens when you have like a boy or children who are learning to doubt and learning to pray, and then there comes tragedies in their life, and you know they almost start to lose it, and God may not really be listening to your prayers?
Now, this question is being asked, of course, in terms of the couple in Mumbai. Many people were saying tehillim for them and praying for them and getting tzedakah for them, and they died. All right. Were the prayers in vain? Are prayers helpful? When we tell children that prayer helps, we're not suggesting that if you pray, you'll never die. Right? We're not saying that if you pray hard enough, you'll live forever. We're not suggesting that. We don't believe that. We don't mean that. We say that prayer is helpful to bring about the goodness that can be or may not be. We don't pray to change nature. Not to die is not natural. So we're not saying that if you pray, you can change the nature of the world. When you pray, if there are if there's a gray area and it can go one of two ways, you pray that it turn out the better way. But not that you should live forever or become instantly rich. I mean, that's not part of the deal at all. You tell a child who davened and prayed for a friend or for a family member, and then the family member passed away, you tell them that when the soul comes to heaven, it can come there empty, alone, solitary, or it can be followed up to heaven by a trail of holy words and of prayers and of davening and of mitzvahs, and that makes a huge difference to the soul. So even if the person did not live the way we hope they would, because death is death, you can't stop that, but the prayers did help that in passing away and in coming to heaven, this soul has the benefit of your prayers and your tzedakah and your mitzvah to accompany it to heaven. So here again we see you have to be clear. You have to speak clearly. You never say to a child, if you pray, then whatever, uncle, whatever, will not die. Don't say things like that. Let me clarify that a little more. There is good and evil in the world. We are fighting, we're struggling to make the good stronger than the evil, bigger than the evil, to remove the evil and build up and increase the good. What can evil do to good? Can evil actually kill people? No, it can't. Evil is darkness. It can't kill. It can't decide who lives and who dies. It's just darkness. It's just the absence of light. So what is evil, and what damage can it do? It can conceal the goodness. That's all it can do. A painful example. 6 million Jews died, martyred, gave up their lives just for being Jewish. That is very holy. But during the Holocaust and after the Holocaust, what did people notice? What did people see? What were people thinking? Nazis, Hitler, trains, gas chambers. Nobody thought holy. Everyone was overwhelmed by the darkness, by the evil of it all. That's what we're trying to avoid. We are trying to create a world through our mitzvahs and through our goodness. We are trying to create a world where the holy and the good cannot be covered up by a blanket of darkness. That the world will not get distracted by the evil and fail to recognize the holy. And that's what we mean, that the time will come and all flesh, every eye, will see God. Is that all we want? That's all that's missing. The only thing that's missing is we don't see it, because there's darkness that hides it and covers it and distracts us from it. When that couple, the Holzbergs in Mumbai, when they died, it was the result of bullets and grenades and ugliness and evil and bloodthirst. People didn't notice that. People noticed them. They were such good people. All they did was offer hospitality day in and day out, and everybody came and enjoyed, and they were wonderful and they were great, and we should do like them. So what happened here? All that evil did not conceal the goodness. Didn't hardly distract us from the goodness. That's called revealing godliness in the world. And what brought that revelation of godliness? What protected that goodness from being buried under the cloak of darkness? The prayers, the tehillim, the mitzvahs that everybody did. And that is our job in this world. Not to create goodness, it already exists, but to make sure that goodness is recognized, understood, appreciated, felt, not covered. And that's why the Kabbalah refers to evil as klipa. It's a covering, it's a shell that hides the good. Our job is to reveal the good and not ever again let darkness hide what is holy. Tehillim helps, did help. And that's why this event brought about such a positive, uplifting response. Not just sympathy. Actual goodness. Which the Holocaust, surprisingly, did not. The goodness of the people in the concentration camps are maybe just now starting to come out. You hear a story here and there, the heroics, the goodness. But until now, all we heard was the darkness, the evil, the horrors. So, in our lives, in our private lives, in our individual lives, we want to make sure that if there is darkness, it doesn't compete with the good. Yes, there's darkness, but how do you let that dampen your goodness? You don't. How do you let darkness hide what's holy? You don't. Until the good and the holy is so obvious, so clear, so strong, that the darkness can't hide it either. And then on that day, God will be one and His name will be one. Nothing will be hidden anymore. That's a good world. So in light of that, if we all do a little more good and make it visible, Hanukkah is coming. It's the one mitzvah that you're supposed to be obnoxious about. Every other mitzvah you do humbly, you do it in private, in a synagogue, in a home. Only the mitzvah of Hanukkah is made to be public. Make it visible. Light up the darkness with a menorah. And the bigger the better. The more visible the better. And so it is with all of holiness. Every mitzvah we do, don't hide it. Don't hide it. Invite people. My brother-in-law lives in Australia. And he made it his project to visit people in Tasmania. Now I think they have a full-time rabbi. But when he first got there, they didn't have a rabbi. And they barely knew that there was... Well, they found one Jewish guy. And they said, how many other Jews are there? He said, I don't think there are any other. They found another one. He said, oh, you're Jewish too. Said, what do you mean? Is another Jew? One didn't know from the other. It seems that after the war, people who were really frightened went to Tasmania and never told anyone they were Jewish, figuring they would disappear, and then they would be safe. But not just one guy thought of it, many thought of it, and they didn't tell each other. So over the weeks that he kept visiting there, he found 40 families, and everyone said, you Jewish? So eventually they found an old abandoned synagogue that had once been there, and he made a rededication, and 200 Jews showed up. Every one of them sure that he was the only one. So he went into one of these shops and he asked this guy there who looked Jewish, would you like to put on film? And at first he said, Absolutely not. Nothing. I'm not going to do anything Jewish. But after a few moments, he realized the Jews are Jew. He said, you know, I think I will. He said, fine, let's go into your office. We'll put on film. He said, no, not in the office. Here. And he called all his non-Jewish workers. He said, I want them to see. I've been hiding long enough. That's good. That's healing. So, don't do it privately, do it publicly. Invite all your friends. Let them all see. Mitzvahs are still mitzvahs. And what God wants is still being performed. And nothing has changed. Good is good. And it's not going to be hidden under fear or under shame or under threats or... Goodness should shine. It should not be hidden. So have a very, very happy Hanukkah. A bright Hanukkah. Things will get brighter if we make them brighter. And this country will be rich. It really will. As soon as we figure out how to turn this into money. There's always a way of turning everything into more wealth. Our generation is destined to be a wealthy generation. This is a, I don't know, just a dip on the road. And we will use our wealth properly for holy things, for good things. And God will have the world He envisioned and is waiting for and is moving towards. The day will come and the world will be a godly place. And your children will be the beneficiaries. Good night.
Just a reminder, everyone, next Tuesday night, Hanukkah is going to be Hanukkah night at the Central Park. With the old Roman rate will be ours, and from 6 to 9 p.m. You go to BibleXlive.org and find out. Hope to see you there.